From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. The world was scared back in April 1986 when word leaked out about the Chernobyl nuclear accident. We looked in the sky and wondered what the winds might carry us. But it wasn't the Soviet Union's first nuclear disaster. On this edition of Fresh Air, research scientist Joris Medvedev, who first told a skeptical West about the Kyshtym accident of 1957, talks about his discoveries of the causes of the Chernobyl explosion. Also today, we meet writer Jim Harrison, whose poems and novels describe memorable characters of courage and comic perception. His latest book is The Woman Lit by Fireflies. And you've lined up for Superman. You've waited for Batman. Stephen Schiff tells us we should queue up one more time to see Darkman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Pentagon announced today the size and scale of this country's first military use of reserve troops since the Vietnam War. NPR's John Burnett reports.
The Pentagon has received the authority to call up as many as 49,700 reservists and National Guard troops belonging to the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard. The mobilization will send most of the reservists overseas to augment the estimated 50,000 troops already in the Middle East or en route. Others will be sent to bases in this country to replace the soldiers who have shipped out. Among other duties, the reservists will fly cargo planes, provide medical services, and load and unload ships and planes. Though most of the reservists will perform these support activities, a Pentagon spokesman said they would not rule out sending them into combat if the standoff turns violent. President Bush has the authority to keep the reserves activated for up to 180 days. Beyond that, though, he has to declare a national emergency and request congressional authorization. The first standby troops will receive phone calls as early as tomorrow, informing them where to report for duty. I'm John Burnett in Washington.
A convoy of American embassy personnel arrived in Baghdad this evening after withdrawing from the U.S. embassy in Kuwait. The group, which included so-called non-essential personnel and U.S. Marine guards, was withdrawn in the face of an Iraqi order to shut the embassy down by midnight tomorrow. Left behind were the ambassador and a small staff maintaining an American presence in defiance of Iraq. An administration official said that the Marines were withdrawn because it was clear that they couldn't fight off an overwhelming number of Iraqi soldiers. The European Economic Community has decided to offer Egypt funds to organize an emergency airlift to evacuate thousands of Egyptians who've poured into Jordan from Iraq. Sylvia Poggioli reports.
The European Economic Community's Executive Commission today offered $1.3 million to Egypt to organize charter flights for Egyptian refugees stranded in Jordan. Last night, Jordan, overwhelmed by the refugee flow, closed its border with Iraq. Thousands of Egyptians are stranded at the border and at the port city of Aqaba, unable to find room on ferries or planes to Egypt. An EC spokesman said the funds will be handed over to Egypt, which together with the International Red Cross could then organize the emergency airlift. The EC hopes that once the refugees are evacuated, the border with Iraq can be reopened. This is Sylvia Poggioli reporting.
The Pentagon acknowledged today that the U.S. Navy has boarded a handful of ships during its week-long effort to block Iraqi shipping. Defense Department spokesman Pete Williams declined to give a specific number of incidents or to say where they occurred. Williams said there was a high degree of voluntary compliance with the effort and that many ships have turned back. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost nearly 77 points to close at 2,483.42. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. A major nuclear accident, an explosion at a nuclear waste dump in the Soviet Union, wreaked great environmental damage in the late 50s, but the accident was kept a secret. So when my guest, scientist Joris Medvedev, published an article about it, the West viewed his claim as a fantasy. So Medvedev, a scientist exiled from the Soviet Union in 1973 for his dissident writings, wrote a book to prove the accident occurred. He searched through official Soviet literature and CIA documents to find proof of the disaster, and his book, Nuclear Disaster in the Urals, is now accepted as the definitive account. Medvedev is now a senior research scientist for the National Institute for Medical Research in London, and once again, he's used his research skills and knowledge of the Soviet Union to investigate the explosion at Chernobyl, April 26, 1986. His account is the book, The Legacy of Chernobyl. Not only are the effects on public health profound, but the accident, says Medvedev, forced the Soviet Union to embrace both perestroika and glasnost. It took 2 days for the rest of the world to find out about the explosion at Chernobyl. I asked Joris Medvedev why it took so long.
Oh, the problem is that Soviet Union usually didn't disclose details about serious industrial accidents, and the government didn't realize that in this case the enormous amount of radioactivity was released, and within one day it's actually reached the Poland and Sweden and Finland. It's only because it was Sunday, nobody in the Western Europe found about this, but Russian service, which monitored radioactivity, was so poor that they didn't actually realize that the radioactivity crossed the border.
You trace the account of the bureaucratic activity in the Soviet Union right after the accident, and it seems that nobody in the Soviet Union took it seriously.
Because in Soviet Union there is very complex system, and people who were on the spot, they tried to falsify or try to minimize the scale of the disaster, and then the ministerial level also tried to minimize. So finally the government got distorted picture and was not able to react accordingly. So just the bureaucratic system where everybody wants to avoid bad news made the Soviet government to react so poorly on this disaster as well.
As I understand it, the initial story was that the reactor exploded as the result of a safety test that went awry, whereas in fact you've discovered that it was a safety system that was being put in several years after it went into operation.
Yes, that's right. The problem is that this reactor needs a special system because this, first of all, the reactor is very, very large. The shutdown system works very, very slow. Therefore, it needed special system which provide electricity in case of blackout or some other accidents. But this system was tested before reactor was completed, but didn't work properly. So finally, official decided to start commercial exploitation of reactor without the system being actually installed. And the only way to make the correction of this error was to wait until the first cycle of reactor work be ended. And this is why they started to install this test system and test, of course, the system when reactor was actually was scheduled for maintenance shutdown, which was most wrong time to try to do something with reactor at this time of the cycle.
You quote a number of conversations that went on at Chernobyl right after the explosion that reveal some of the attitudes of officials, and some of them read like a play by Havel or Kafka. A minister asks, why does the station not have the proper monitoring instruments, some radiometers to measure the amount of radiation? And the minister is told, ah, sir, the accident wasn't in the plan. The unthinkable has happened.
Oh, yes, it's very strange. The description of the governmental commission first meetings and some other stories indicate that even director of the whole power station didn't have proper dosimeters. Neither the safety department nor actually individual reactor engineers or plant manager had any dosimeter which would give you reading when serious contamination happened. All the dosimeters were very primitive type, and only the civil defense and then army did bring the proper dosimeters, because army had dosimeters which were scaled for the case of nuclear war, and this happened to be proper systems to measure activities.
Now, a dosimeter was actually ruled to be, if you had one, it was considered a criminal offense after this accident.
Oh, yes. It's after this accident, all research institutes in Kyiv and some other areas in Soviet Union where dosimeters did exist, they were forbidden to make measurements outside of laboratories, and even inside laboratories, they were sealed. But now the situation changed under pressure from the population in Belarus and Ukraine. Finally, the dosimeters were legalized, and the Soviet Union now even tried to make commercial pocket dosimeters for population and to give it to people in order to introduce certain elements of calm and trust, because people do not trust official measurement. They want to measure themselves.
It seems that there have been a significant shift in psychological attitudes. In part, anxiety is increased when people have less information, when they know that there is a genuine emergency at hand.
Oh yes, this is certainly true, but it's not only psychological. The problem is that a lot of restrictions were introduced by the Ministry of Health. People were not allowed to drink milk from their cows, from locally produced milk. They were not allowed to eat some fruits, collect mushrooms in the forest, which is a century-old tradition in Russia. They were not allowed to walk in the forest. Children were not allowed to play outside. Therefore, the population, which continued to live in heavily contaminated area, realized that something is extremely hazardous around, that they felt that they live in very unhealthy or dangerous environment, and therefore all health troubles, even cold or anything which they suffer from, either old age or children troubles and so on, would be linked to Chernobyl. But what is worse, it now realized that damage to the thyroids, because iodine, radioactive iodine level was very, very high during the first few weeks. The damage to the thyroid is really very serious, and thousands of children are suffering of effect of thyroid deficiency now. And this, of course, created very serious anger of the population. And the government now has tried to realize certain measures, even sending these children to many countries for treatment in order to show people that they're doing their best in order to improve their health.
You make the point that the need for the Soviet government to finally open up about what had happened at Chernobyl led both to perestroika and to glasnost. I wonder if you could explain that connection.
Well, first of all, glasnost was not real glasnost before Chernobyl accident. There were some very select. It was improvement with the situation before, but the government still used the censorship. Censorship was abolished only from August 1st this year. But when Chernobyl happened, glasnost was again in trouble, because people in Ukraine and in Belarus and in Soviet Union, they realized that the government is telling actually false information, again, kind of propaganda, false information, and this created very serious political problems in Ukraine and Belarus, because local officials, when election time, they lost their seats, because public was very angry about all this false information they were told. So finally, at the local level, they started to ignore all the restrictions, and finally it became impossible to keep the full truth from the public. And only last April, the Supreme Soviet discussed and debated the Chernobyl problem, and the Party Congress last July debated Chernobyl problem in the way they should do this from the very beginning. So finally, you can't hide the disaster of this scale. You can't hide the health problem of scale, which affect millions of people. And therefore, after 4 years, they started to tell real truth. And unfortunately, this didn't help people who already absorbed very significant dose of radiation and will suffer next decade.
My guest is Joris Medvedev. He's a senior research scientist for the National Institute for Medical Research in London. His new book is The Legacy of Chernobyl. What have been the effects of radiation on food supply and some of the long-term effects of radiation that we've seen over the past few years? Will there be future health problems caused from eating this food?
Well, this is a very serious problem, but Soviet Union actually didn't destroy neither meat nor milk. They tried to use processing in order to reduce contamination level, and they also did rise for the first few weeks did raise the permissible standards in order to accommodate very, very heavy contamination.
What do you mean by processing? Like making hamburger?
Like making butter from milk, because milk was considered entirely useless because it had a very high level of either radioactive iodine or cesium. But if you make butter, and then from butter most of the liquid is removed, and therefore a lot of radioactive products also removed. Butter still will have radioactivity, but it's be lower level. So by this way, it was possible to remove some radioactivity and to use these products. Also, they decided to use, let us say, contaminated meat, not for human consumption, but for animal consumption, for other purposes, for cat food or dog's food and so on. So nothing was actually destroyed. And this is, of course, is very serious problem, because sometimes this contaminated food was used for sausages. They tried to mix contaminated meat with clean meat from other regions. They used to send carcasses of contaminated meat all over the Soviet Union, where it was in meat plants, was processed with other meats. Finally, in order to reduce the level of radioactive cesium down to the so-called permissible level. But this was very short-sighted practice, because eventually it will increase the incidence of cancer, incidence of other disease. So finally, the government or the country will lose. But this effect will be visible only in 20 and 30 and 40 years time. So I think officials decided that nobody will be able to recognize when it's all be well forgotten. But I feel that it will not be forgotten for many years yet.
How did you do your research for this, to learn about the hidden details of the Chernobyl accident? How did you learn about the details of what's actually going on in an area that's been closed off to the outside world?
No, I used my experience because I did study the previous very serious nuclear accident in Kishtym in Urals in 1957. I published a book about it in 1979. This accident was entirely unknown in the West, and in Soviet Union also very few people knew about this. So I used analysis of literature, analysis of all kind of publication everywhere, in Soviet biological, medical newspapers, local newspapers, all reports, Soviet report for International Agency for Atomic Energy, American report of American the Department of Energy. Many countries publish their reports, and by comparing these reports with previous publications, I was able to find, for example, about that this was not the test of the new safety system. It was installment of the system which should be already there, because I found the description of design requirements of this reactor and so on. So you need actually to read a lot of literature and to try to analyze this literature like kind of scientific detection story. And then you might find some pieces of information which give you opportunity to recreate the real scale and real developments.
My guest is scientist Joris Medvedev. His new book is The Legacy of Chernobyl. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is scientist Joris Medvedev. Your father was arrested when you and your twin brother, the historian Roy Medvedev, were 12. How did this incident shape your life?
Well, it did shape my life and my brother's life in a very profound way, because, first of all, loss of the father was major family disaster, and it changed our attitude toward the system, toward the Soviet life, because it's very specific life. It changed other people's attitude toward us. We became kind of isolated family. We were evicted from the apartment where we lived, so we had to travel to different places to ask support of our relatives, which gave us support. and so on. Finally, it affected us until the actually Stalin death, because in all Soviet questionnaires, all Soviet promotions, you need to fill to answer questions. Either you have relatives who been repressed by Soviet state, and you answer yes, and you give details about this. So it's affected life in a way that we were discriminated in many ways, but we were able to survive, and probably it gave us some immunity from harassment later, when it's also we had to face some problems during Brezhnev time.
What do you remember about your father's arrest the night the Stalin's KGB came to the door?
Oh, it's very good in my memory, because we've been all at home. We already were sleeping, actually. It was they used to come to houses after midnight. So I just was wakened by the very strong knock in the door. I heard my father answer, somebody else talk. Then I again fell asleep. But when I waked, was already search in the apartment, because they had to search apartment in order to try to find something subversive, something anti-Soviet. It's a kind of usual routine of the arrest. So they came to a room where we were sleeping. They were searching the room, trying to find something. Our father was a military man, officer. And therefore, I immediately realized that this is the arrest, because fathers of some of my friends were arrested before. It was not first arrest I witnessed, not witnessed, but I knew about, because it was nearly 2 years of terror, or 2 years of arrests in Soviet Union. My father was arrested in 1938, but the peak of the arrest was in 1937, so we immediately realized that this was the arrest of our father, and then it was minutes of saying goodbye and kisses and crying and so on. It was terrible morning, yes, for all of us, for our mother, for my brother as well.
And you never saw him again?
Oh, we never saw him again, yes. We received some letters from his place of his exile in Kolyma, in Magadan, in Far East, but there were a few letters trying to encourage us, but then we found that he was ill, and then our letters started to return back with the notice that Adrisi died. So it again was a terrible shock for my mother, for myself, for my brother. It was just a few months before the war. It was very senseless, because Stalin actually decapitated nearly 90% of high-ranking officers and generals were arrested before the war, which made war much more bloody and much more difficult for the whole country.
What had you been doing to have the Soviet regime later assign you to a mental hospital for, what was it, paranoid delusions of reforming society?
Yeah, that's right, yes. Oh, it was because I was working in science, and it was at the time of Khrushchev, there was pseudoscientific, during Stalin time as well, Lysenko affair, so-called Lysenko domination in biology and in genetics. And many geneticists, many biologists fighted Lysenko. And I did write a book about Lysenko, about his pseudoscientific, how he became so influential and so on. And this book was circulating in so-called Samizdat, very widely circulated. And finally, I decided to publish it, but nobody wanted to publish it in Soviet Union. So I decided to publish it in the United States, and it was published in 1969. And after this book was published, I was immediately dismissed from my position as the head of the laboratory in Molecular Biology Institute. But I continued to write, decided to write some more works on Soviet science, on plight of Soviet science. And when they realized that I continue to write rather than to confess or to express regret about what I have done, they put me into mental hospital. And then finally I was released.
What did they do to you when you were in the mental hospital?
Oh, they didn't do anything. They tried to convince me that I am ill. They didn't started any kind of drug therapy because immediately after I was put in mental hospital, there was very many protests from very prominent scientists inside Soviet Union and outside Soviet Union. So my case was under constant supervision from world community of scientists, from foreign journalists in Moscow. So they were not not actually trying to treat me from my delusions. Finally, I was released, but release was not just acceptance that I am healthy. They just told that I'm not so badly ill to be in hospital, so I could be outpatient so, to visit them every month, which I, of course, didn't make.
So you've been an outpatient in London since, what, 1973?
Yes, 73, yes.
Is your brother still in the Soviet Union?
Oh, he's still, he's in Soviet Union. He actually became very influential figure. He was elected as a member of People's Congress and as member of Supreme Soviet as well. So he's now member of parliament, like a congressman in America. And his books were published last year and this year on Stalin and some other problems. So he became quite a prominent figure among Soviet and Russian intellectuals.
It seems that the Chernobyl accident has sparked perestroika and glasnost, sort of curious fallout, if you will, from the accident, and also has affected attitudes about nuclear energy in a country that has been dependent on energy generated by nuclear power plants. How will the Soviet Union change its need for power? Will it try to go for more oil from the Middle East, for instance?
Not really. First of all, they have a problem with currency. According to Soviet program, which was actually delivered in end of 1985, the Gorbachev report, Soviet Union was expected to have 20-25% of all electricity from nuclear energy in 1990, which is this year, and about 45% of all energy requirement from nuclear energy in the year 2000. And this program wasn't entirely irrelevant now. It's actually clear to everybody. So all the Soviet long-term programs were linked to development of nuclear energy. And when this happened not to be the case or not possible anymore, and it took 2 or 3 years for the government to realize, then perestroika did take a different turn. They started to think about energy-saving technologies. They started to think about market economy as more efficient, more oriented to consumers. So the whole blueprint for development of Soviet Union changed as a result, because they realized that there is no any room to increase the energy output in the country, at least for the next 5-10 years, and they need to find different ways to economize, and they decided to follow the same way which Western world made during energy crisis in the 70s, where the energy-saving economies started to emerge as the best way to solve the crisis.
Dr. Medvedev, thank you very much for coming and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Georges Medvedev. His book is The Legacy of Chernobyl. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, cinematographer Frederick Elms. His latest film is David Lynch's Wild at Heart. He also worked with Lynch on Blue Velvet, Eraserhead, and Dune. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. My guest today finds a grueling book tour a zen exercise. He has to make a conscious effort to free his mind and open it up again. Coming up, we talk with author Jim Harrison and find out more about his new collection of novellas, The Woman Lit by Fireflies, and his not-so-isolated writer's life in rural Upper Michigan. And will it be worthwhile to brave the elements to queue up for the new movie, Dark Man? Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Bush administration has pulled Marine guards and most diplomats out of the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait, a contingent that has now arrived in Baghdad. Iraq has ordered all foreign embassies closed by midnight Friday, but the U.S. ambassador and a small staff are still in Kuwait City. Iraq's Saddam Hussein has made a rare television appearance with a small group of Western hostages, which included several children. The broadcast, seen in the U.S. and Iraq, featured a smiling Saddam in a business suit. The Iraqi leader was shown lecturing and taking questions from his captives. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
The Iraqi president appeared relaxed as he spoke through an interpreter to a group of English-speaking Westerners gathered in an office. "Your presence here and in other places is meant to prevent the scourge of war," he told them. When asked by one of the televised hostages how long they would be held in Iraq, Saddam said, "Regrettably, there is no dialogue with us yet." Iraq's chief ally, Jordan's King Hussein, began a round of diplomacy in Arab capitals to find what he called an Arab solution to the Gulf crisis. However, in another speech read by an announcer on Baghdad TV, Saddam blasted Kuwait's deposed ruling family and the Saudi Arabian king. They plotted against Iraq, he said. His comments came in an open letter to Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak, calling on Egypt's leader to join him in representing the poor Arabs rather than the rich. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
According to Radio Baghdad, President Saddam Hussein has issued an order that a 15-year-old British boy separated from his family by the Persian Gulf crisis be sent home. The BBC, which heard that announcement, said the boy's name was not clearly heard, but sounded like Alex Cameron Farney. The U.S. and the Soviet Union have been working closely together in the Persian Gulf crisis, but now a dispute has developed over Soviet military advisors in Iraq. Barry Schweid has more on the story.
The Bush administration is still praising Moscow, and for good reason. The Soviets parted with their old allies by supporting UN sanctions and declaring a cutoff in weapon shipments. But more than 200 Soviet military advisors are still helping Iraq, far from the battlefield, Moscow has told the U.S. privately. The State Department isn't ready to accuse the Soviets of violating the sanctions, but spokesman Richard Boucher said the sanctions do extend to military advisors and their presence in Iraq isn't appropriate. The State Department has been saying the same thing to Moscow privately as well. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 77 points to close at 2,483.42, on volume of over 250 million shares. Trading was very heavy as declining issues led advances by a margin of 11 to 1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. My guest today, poet and novelist Jim Harrison, worked as a hod carrier who occupied his thoughts with poetry and paced his work by playing in his mind the music of Stravinsky. He now makes enough money from screenplays to write his novels and poems without having to carry bricks. Because of his outdoor themes and active male characters, some compare him to Hemingway, but Harrison says Faulkner is a literary mentor for the depth of character he likes to develop. His writing has garnered acclaim and admirers, many of whom are men attracted to his themes and rugged characters. My guest travels widely but prefers to live in Upper Michigan, where the hunting and fishing are good, and it takes a while to find him. He was in New York the other day to talk about his new book, a collection of three novellas, each distinctly different in style and character. One of them ran recently in The New Yorker, The Woman Lit by Fireflies. I asked Jim Harrison to read from the opening.
She had not yet accepted as real the quiver in her stomach and the slight green dot of pain in the middle of her head that signaled an incipient migraine. Her husband on the car seat beside her punched in a tape called Tracking the Blues, which contained no black music, but rather the witless drone of a weekly financial lecture sent from New York City. This particular tape was 7 days stale and had been played 3 times on their trip, but Donald repeated it to get fair value for his money. The tape not incidentally replaced Stravinsky's Histoire du Soldat from an Iowa City FM station, a piece she always enjoyed. Do you mind, darling? He asked. Not at all, dear, she replied, partly because the pain clinic she had attended in Arizona that spring had emphasized giving up resistance to outside phenomena at the possible onset of a migraine under the notion you wanted to starve rather than feed the affliction.
Have you suffered migraines yourself?
No, I haven't, but at this clinic, sort of spa clinic in Mexico, I ran into a lot of somewhat middle-aged ladies that had, and I seemed to always been interested as an artist in the subject of pain, and I had one aunt with severe or terminal migraines, so I became interested in the perceptual distortions that take place, too, just before a migraine, you know, which are similar to those that precede grand mal seizures and epilepsy.
The story is told from a woman's point of view, which is a point of view you took in your novel, Dalva. How did you shift your sense of perspective to capture a sense of woman in pain?
Well, I think it started... perhaps 10 years ago. It's that Buddhist notion, really, is to study the self is to forget the self. And if you can manage to forget yourself, then you can be anyone, you know. And so when her voice arrived, that's usually, it's as if someone were talking to you. When her voice arrived, I was receptive, you know, and slipped into that voice.
This is Claire's voice.
Yes.
How did Claire's voice arrive for you?
Well, one night I was thinking of, again, those ladies at the spa, and I was out in the barnyard of my farm, and it was a particularly strange summer night, and the swamp and the marsh near the barnyard was almost dense with fireflies. You know, so that's when I thought of a woman, you know, who's left her husband at a rest stop, you know, on the highway and just climbed over the fence and ran off in a cornfield. So somehow that whole beginning came to me right at that point.
I like the idea of the woman crossing the cornfield. It was very much almost like a pilgrimage across a desert that she was making.
Yeah, that is... it's almost ritualized, you know, building her little shelter there by a river, falling in and consequently feeling baptized by it, and then cleansed later, you know, when she washes by the irrigation pipe, that kind of thing. Because, of course, if you're going to make that violent change in life, the more ritualized you make it, the more permanent it would be.
Have you used ritual to change your life?
Well, somewhat, yes, of course. You know, I have to. I don't, I found out at this advanced age, when am I 52, that I'm a great deal more fragile than I thought. So I do spend a lot of time by myself in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, walking, you know. I think I took 50 or 60 walks this summer, and I never saw another human being, so that's part of the ritual, you know.
You're in New York as we're talking. What kind of journey would you take to get home? How would you go?
Fly to Detroit or Chicago, then fly up to near Traverse City. And that's where my farm is, and then my cabin's way up in the Upper Peninsula. So my farm is about 300 miles north of Detroit, and then the place in the Upper Peninsula is another 200 miles further north.
So it takes a long time to get there.
Oh, yeah.
But
then I got to see, two years ago, I saw a timber wolf in the log road near my cabin, so you don't get to see that here, so it's worth the trip.
I live in California and in San Francisco, and Terry, who normally does the show, lives here in Philadelphia. We're on the coast, and you've described these coasts as dream coasts that are not conscious of the geography of the interior. What are we missing by not being in Michigan?
Well, I'm not so sure you're missing anything. It's a predilection, you know. When I was 19, I had to live in both New York City and San Francisco. I mean, I had to see them. In fact, I hitchhiked all the way to California to see the Pacific Ocean, just out of curiosity. But that's sort of one of those goofy things a Midwestern farm kid does, you know, out of Sherwood Anderson. I want to see the ocean, so I saved up $40 and off I went. I wasn't disappointed at all.
My guest is author Jim Harrison. His poetry includes the volume The Theory and Practice of Rivers. His other books include the novels Sundog and Dalva, and a new collection of novellas called The Woman Lit by Fireflies. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with writer Jim Harrison. Many of your readers over the years, through your novels, including Wolf, A False Memoir, and Sundog, have been a male. There's an attraction, there's a gutsiness of your writing that seems to attract male readers. And sometimes reviewers have commented on your macho life or your macho mm-hmm. writing. What do you think reviewers mean by this? And do you consider yourself macho or whatever that might mean?
Well, no, I mean, it's oddly enough, that's what I meant by the remoteness. I'm not so sure we're the United States of America in that sense, because I grew up, it's just the way I grew up, fishing and hunting and in the woods. And that's just what one did. It's the same as kids grow up playing stickball in New York. So it just reflected my background, you know. We're a child of the culture from which we emerge, and I mean, still, one of the other novellas in here called Brown Dog is very much reflects that background. I just didn't want to feel limited by a voice, and I think part of the whole macho thing was partly from the feminist movement, people very sensitive about the issue. But I, having spent a great deal of time in Mexico, I think a macho is someone that throws a rattler in a baby carriage or something like that. You know, it's gratuitous cruelty is what macho is. And I certainly am a kind old soul myself, as it were.
There's an author's note in Sundog where you say, describing the character you're writing about, I must content myself with having known a man completely free of the bondage of the appropriate. Could you elaborate on the idea of the bondage of the appropriate?
Well, it's the idea, you know, I remembered Walt Whitman's introduction to Leaves of Grass, you know, where the sense of, in other cultures too, the free man is the man who has absolutely no habits, you know, of any sort, you know. Like they say in Zen, if you want a drink, have a drink, you know, but make sure that's what you want, that kind of thing. But the appropriate in every sense, to be free of all constraints of any sort, But the way you free yourself from all constraints is by the extremist form of discipline, you know.
You seem drawn to ideas of Zen philosophy. Have you spent time sitting Zazen?
Well, yeah, but mostly on my own because I'm not around in the vicinity of any Roshi, though I did study with Koben Shino Sensei, who is down in Palo Alto for a while and is now in New Mexico. In fact, a Zen friend or priest gave me a quote to take on this book tour. You'd like, listen to this one.
Okay.
Regard this juggling, this so-called universe, as a picture show. Thus be happy. That's pretty strong, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it keeps you light, as it were.
So you were able to distance yourself then and enjoy the entertainment of this parade?
Yeah, I don't think it's even distance yourself because you have to be totally present if you're going to do this. It's mm-hmm. pain. It's more, people should know, it's more painful to distance yourself, you know. I mean, just be where you are with all your heart and mind, and sooner or later you'll find yourself someplace else.
One of your poems, First Day of Painting, every other line refers to one of the subjects you want to paint as a nude woman, nude women.
Mm-hmm.
What is erotic for you about writing?
Well, I don't know. I've been accused of this. This is true, too, that sometimes there's a tendency in, while you're writing that when you're what they call horny, you write a sex scene, and when you're hungry, you have a food scene, you know. And I like to write about, it's an intoxication with the ordinary in life. I think writers get lost by being very brilliant about perimeters and being very brilliant about edges, and then they forget the core, you know. Mm. And food and sex are, shall we say, at the core, you know.
What is the importance of garlic in your life?
I couldn't live without it, frankly. I get a lot of mail from young writers, and I always advise them, and I'm very hesitant to give advice because I reflected that five or six, maybe even seven of the people I had given advice to had committed suicide, you know, during my lifetime. So now I just tell young writers, don't forget red wine and garlic.
And has the survival rate of people you've given advice to increased?
No one who's followed that dictum has committed suicide. It's a guarantee.
How did you first discover the powers of garlic?
Well, it's from growing up in a Swedish farm family in northern Michigan where there was no garlic, and I came to New York City to be a beatnik and to imitate. I wanted to be like Modigliani, you know, the crazy painter, un vibre of maison tante, you know, that kind of thing. So my first week in what I call Greenwich Village, I discovered this garlic, and I thought, my God. Now I treat it as a vegetable. You've been in Mustards, have you? Up in Napa Valley?
I've been past it. No,
yeah,
I've been...
you know, Cindy Paulson roasts whole heads of garlic basted with olive oil and thyme, you know, or rosemary, fresh rosemary. And then you eat the garlic cloves. They're softened and roasted. You eat them with an oyster fork and spread them on toast.
It's the latest drug of choice, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm glad I was in there early. I still try to collect a lot of California wines, too.
Is your wine cellar the result of affluence or the result of gifts?
Well, no. I called it the Warner Brothers Memorial Wine Cellar for a while. Because I was 39, I think, before I made what they call real money. 12 years ago, and I tended to fall into the trap that successful boxers do, you know. I squandered it all, but I did manage to build up a really considerable wine cellar.
When you're writing a book, do you take pages of it and read them aloud to your wife?
No, not that, though she reads. She and my oldest daughter, who is perhaps my best editor, read them first, you know, in manuscript, to see if I haven't done something totally ill-advised.
And do you take their advice?
Yeah, frequently, you know. So my daughter teased me and Dalva about pulling back from certain sex scenes, so I amplified them, you know.
Well, that's an interesting relationship you have with your daughter.
Yeah, well, she was teasing. Well, she's 29. She's been around, as it were, and she just did notice that I get a little squeamish at times, you know, or feel that I can't handle it.
You lost your left eye in a childhood accident, and there was a nice way of that you described it in one of your poems. Your left eye is blind and jogs like a milky sparrow in its socket.
Yeah, that's an odd image, isn't it?
How a milky sparrow? Have you seen a milky sparrow?
Well, it's just the idea, a little wobbly little bird in my head. You know, that I like to say I can see ladies in the full moon with my blind eye, which, of course, isn't quite true, you know. Jogs, yeah.
Did you replace it with an artificial eye, or do you keep a patch?
No. That was the horror of the experience. They thought they were going to pull it out. It's still in. But when I was 7 in this hospital, a salesman of eyes came by, you know, and I got to see all the possibilities. He had a big case full of about 500 glass eyes, you know.
This must have been really startling as a 7-year-old.
Yes, it sort of stuck with me for a while. Now, the worst thing about the experience is where we lived, there were no diesel trains, and at night I would hear this diesel train, you know, that horn, and I didn't know what it was, so I naturally assumed it was dragons, you know, moaning out there in the dark. So I suppose that was constituted a trauma, you know, the experience.
Well, I've liked sitting down and talking with you today on Fresh Air.
I enjoy it.
Writer Jim Harrison, whose books include The Volume of Poetry, The Theory and Practice of Rivers, and a new collection of novellas, The Woman Lit by Fireflies. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, host Linda Wertheimer has stopped by to give us a preview. Hello, Linda.
Hello, Sedge. Today we saw Saddam Hussein again. He made a major speech on television from Iraq, but he also appeared on television talking to some British and Irish workers who are hostages, in effect, in Iraq, just chatting with them, playing with their children, an extraordinary sight. We have some disturbing news from Poland as well about Americans being used as shields in Iraq. Oil prices are up, markets are down, and the reserves have finally been called up officially. We'll have all of that tonight.
Full reports on the Middle East news on All Things Considered later here on National Public Radio. In the mid-1980s, Sam Raimi and his friends Ethan and Joel Cohen, who've made Blood Simple and Raising Arizona, constituted a school of Midwestern low-budget independent filmmaking. The three were steeped in movie culture. Raimi and the Coens have since moved out to the coast to bigger projects. Raimi's new movie is Dark Man. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
The music is by Danny Elfman, the man who did the spooky scores for Batman and Dick Tracy, and it sounds exactly like those. It's all mist and foreboding, and it immediately puts you in a certain kind of gothic mood. In fact, Dark Man wants to be a gothic thriller of the tragic, romantic, slightly soupy French persuasion. I'm talking about stuff like The Phantom of the Opera, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Eyes Without a Face, The Cocteau Beauty and the Beast, and its descendant on TV. You know the story. There's the dark world of the beast, who's hideously deformed in some way, but whose soul is radiantly beautiful. And then there's the bright world of the beauty, an innocent woman preyed upon by forces of evil. In Darkman, the Beast is Peyton Westlake, played by Liam Neeson. He's a scientist working on a formula to regenerate human skin. The Beauty is Julie Hastings, played by Frances McDormand. She's Peyton's lawyer girlfriend, and she's gotten her hands on an incriminating memorandum that the town's baddest bad guys want. They want it so much, in fact, that the head bad guy, Durant, played by Larry Drake, takes his gang to Peyton's laboratory to find it.
We've come only for documents. Tell us where to find the Belisarius memorandum and we shall disappear. Like a nightmare before the breaking day.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Unfortunate.
Moments later, Peyton's lab has been blown to smithereens, and Peyton has been hideously disfigured. Yet, unbeknownst to anyone, he lives. And with his terrific skin regeneration techniques, he's able to replace his own ruined face with anyone's, even his own, for 99 minutes, whereupon the skin cells destabilize and turn to muck. But the accident and certain details of his recovery have unhinged our hero. They've made him strangely emotional and at times extremely violent, especially when he decides to go after the gang that destroyed his life.
Oh, his name's Robert G. Durant! I told you everything!
I know, Rick. I know you did. But let's pretend you didn't.
I won't tell you just what is happening there to Peyton's poor victim, but let's just say that as French Gothic goes, you might think that scene lacks a certain refinement, a certain je ne sais quoi. Fortunately, you'd be right. Where all those other Phantom of the Opera derivations are self-pitying and syrupy, Darkman turns out to be goofy, comic booky, exuberantly adolescent. The director, Sam Raimi, is the all-American nutcase who made the delirious horror movie The Evil Dead, and his delirium hasn't abated with the years. Darkman jumps and wriggles with Raimi's crazed camera angles and his louder-than-life color schemes, not to mention his own special zoom shot, where he picks up the camera and literally runs at top speed toward his subject, filming all the while. Darkman walks a fine line between wince-making fruitiness and laugh-out-loud satire. What it lacks in taste and decorum, it more than makes up for in energy. And it even has its own giddy brand of finesse. There are action scenes in this movie that are as brilliantly conceived and edited as anything since The Best of Hitchcock. If you go expecting French, romantic, haunting, you'll be disappointed. Go expecting fun, and you'll be rewarded in spades.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air is produced this week by Fred Landerall. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Bob Alls. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, cinematographer Frederick Elms tells us about working behind the camera on David Lynch's new movie, Wild at Heart. And Doug Peacock talks to us about his life amongst the grizzly bears. That's next time on Fresh Air.